Interview with Anil Munasinghe, 28th of December, 1967.
The first question you wanted to know was how I came into politics. Well, I suppose it starts this way, that my family has been in politics. My granduncle is Anagarika Dharmapala.
Oh, I see, of course.
So in our family, from young days, we were taught to be very nationalistic. And, from those days, I really wanted to be our country. From the recent period. And my earliest memories are those of our leaders of that time, the Baron Jayatilaka, D.S. Senan, and others, as being people who really did not fight the British to a successful conclusion. In fact, they were, or it appeared to me, that they were capitulating to them. Well, I was thoroughly dissatisfied with that situation. And when the Second World War broke out, I really sympathized with those who were against the British, against the Germans. And they saw the Japanese, and I suppose, like a lot of young middle class people, I looked upon the Japanese as a nation to
free Ceylon.
Not to free Ceylon, but to give them, when they were giving a fight to the British in India, that we would also be able to not to go under the Japanese, certainly not, because I didn't really agree with Subhas Chandra Bose's attitude at all. But I really wanted the British to be beaten and for us to have the help of some other nation, because obviously we didn't have arms and so on. So when I was in this state of mind, really, I began to look towards communism. And I found that the Soviet Union also was doing a good fight. And in my own mind, I didn't see a contradiction in Soviet policy at that time, which was for a people's war and so on. And I really thought that the Soviet Union would help the struggle of colonial people. So I began to read Lenin and so on, but I remember to this day, I read one book of Lenin's on imperialism, and there I had underlined several passages which showed that the Soviet Union and the Communist Party of Iran was not carrying out a proper attitude of struggle against imperialism. Mm-hmm. And at that time I was at Royal College. At Royal we had, unbeknown to ourselves, Mr. R.T.L. Artigal, who was at that time a member of the Samasamaja Party, which was proscribed. So he gave us these general ideas without ever indicating that they were Trotskyist ideas. So it was only at the end of the war, really, when I went to England, that I came into contact with official Trotskyists. In Ceylon itself, apart from Dickie Artigal, and Osman Jayaratna, who is now at the university, who was also with me in the formation of the first communist group inside Royal College.
Was it a communist group or a Trotsky group?
Communist group.
Communist group. Yes, in fact, one of the questions I was going to ask you was why you, in the end, have ended up with the Trotsky instead of the CP.
So, I thought that I was dissatisfied with Communist Party policy even at that time, obviously, because that's why I went to Trotsky. And Aussie also went to...
But were there any, influences in England which sent you in this direction?
No, because when the first week itself, when I was in England, I tried to contact the Revolutionary Communist Party, but I was not able to do so. And it wasn't until I went to the university, London University, that I made contact with students there. And funnily enough, it was an anarchist girl student who took me to the headquarters of the RCP. And I formed the first Trotskyist group at University College, London. After that.
What were you doing there? I mean, what subject?
I was doing law, studying law. So I was a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party from 1945, December onwards.
And then thereafter, once coming back?
Well, I was there, I did work inside the Communist Party. I met my wife there. She was a communist. And then we worked, I convinced her the rightness of Trotskyism. And we worked inside the Communist Party.
To
extraction workers, yeah. Then we were expelled. And when we were expelled, we worked openly in the Revolutionary Communist Party until we decided to enter the Labour Party as a group. And we were sent as the advance guard into the Labour Party. And in fact, my wife became the secretary of the Labour Party in Eton and Slough, her hometown. And we worked inside the Labour Party, inside the National Council of Labour Colleges, which has the biggest educational, which is the biggest educational organization in the British working class movement. And we continue to work in the youth leagues, the British Labour Party youth leagues. When we came to Ceylon in 1952, we entered the LSSP here. But I must mention that while I was in England, the Trotskyist movement split. And a section went into the Labour Party. Recognizing the Labour Party as the only way forward, we refused to do so. And we worked in a group led by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Healy. And because we held certain views on the Soviet Union, called state capitalist, which we termed as state capitalist at that time, we were expelled from the Trotskyist movement also. So when we came to Ceylon, we were really expelled members. But when we came here, we joined the LSSP on a condition that we would not raise the Russian question.
Mm-hmm. So what is your attitude to the Healyite movement now and the activities of people like Tony Banda?
Oh, they are a small sectarian group, you see. This is, I think, the tragedy of the revolutionary movement. After the breakup of the Third International and the defeat of the opposition in Russia, the Communist Party became the instruments of the state apparatus, the Soviet Union. And more they became dependent on that state apparatus for funds, and mental makeup also was one of subservience to the Soviet bureaucracy. Unfortunately, because of the resources wielded by the Soviet state, the crisis of capitalism in Europe and America, people began to look towards something which would provide an answer, and they found that in the Soviet Union, and or what they conjured up to be the Soviet Union. There's no doubt that the planned economy and the nationalized economy of the Soviet Union was a tremendous advance. There's no doubt, I mean, in the minds of anybody. But there were certain drawbacks, certain shortcomings, which these people were not prepared to recognize. But we, with our Marxist training, our scientific background, which we naturally had to recognize ourselves.
Both with reference to your Marxism and with reference to your steps in the direction of Marxism and the rejection of the Soviet Union, was it so much books or the concrete situation which led you into this idea?
I think in the first instance here in Ceylon, it was a concrete situation, because concretely I found that the Communist Party did not carry out its opposition to British imperialism. On the contrary, it was sort of backsliding. In the first instance, therefore, I should say it was a concrete situation. But more and more intellectually, by reading, I was convinced that the Soviet Communist Party and the Stalinist bureaucracy was not on the proper road. And more and more intellectually, after reading most of the books which were now taboo as far as the official communists are concerned, I became convinced that Stalinism must have socialism. For one thing, I thought, and I think, socialism is a movement which is better than capitalism. It has to be.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it cannot replace it. This is because capitalism has certain shortcomings that we are looking for a new system. And obviously, therefore, the new system must not have the shortcomings of the capitalist system. When we say that we want more democracy, we really mean it. When we want freedom for the intellectual, freedom in culture, and so on, we mean it. You cannot have double things and say, well, in the Soviet Union it is permissible to have these shortcomings because in the interest of socialism it is necessary. I say no.
That's not socialism.
That's not socialism. So, that is the approach. And the other thing is, I feel that a movement which is bringing forward a new society must be truthful, must be honest. These are qualities that are necessary. And also, there is a humanism, which is entirely lacking in Stalin. It was a merely mechanistic, impersonalized movement. And that I do not think is suitable.
But see, now, since you helped to bring about the Steliad group, isn't there some sort of contradiction in your present attitude to that group?
In what way?
In the sense that you broke away from that, from the main Trotsky group in England.
Oh, yes.
But now you feel that the Heliites are sectarian and tend to divide the move.
It's not that the Heliites are now sectarian. Mm-hmm. I feel that when you live in that environment in England, as I was trying to explain,
mm-hmm.
With the defeat of the left opposition in Russia and the left opposition in most of the communist parties in the world, the Trotskyist movement and the opposition was isolated from the mainstream of the working class movement. And when you get isolated from the mainstream of the working class movement, the result is that certain theoretical conceptions begin to play a much greater part than they really should. For instance, if I have argued with intellectuals of the Communist Party and others over a meaning of a sentence for perhaps a day. But in the course of a struggle, those things do not carry that same importance. So, you see, what I want to say is that when you are isolated, you tend to turn inward and take part in discussion, which tends to become more sterile than anything else. Whereas when you are in the movement, you may make a lot of mistakes, but you are in a living movement, which itself is the corrective to put you on the proper path to socialism. That's the, I do not say therefore, the Healy is a product of the isolation of the British Revolutionary Movement. And today, on the, I suppose, really, particularly after the Second World War, and even more after that, after the death of Stalin and the development of currents within the Soviet and Eastern European Communist Parties, of centrifugal forces, the rise of China and the rise of Cuba, now there is an independent force coming out. And I think the revolutionary movement is becoming less and less isolated. And therefore, now take Fidel Castro for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I think his movement itself is an answer to the to what I have said. Nobody ever dreamt that the Fidel Castro's assault on the Moncada barrack would result in a revolution in Cuba. Because everybody thought that only the Communist Party could lead the revolution. But we know that today it's not the Communist Party that's leading revolutions in Algeria. It was the FLN to which the Communists were opposed. In Cuba it was Fidel Castro. In Latin America new parties are rising.
What is your attitude to the Mao line and the Mao group here?
Well, I think that the Chinese question is a very complex question. It's very difficult to answer in say a few sentences. But I would say generally it is this. China is undergoing the same type of development the Soviet Union undergoing. Under Stalin. Only in the person of Mao it combines the attributes of Lenin, our Trotsky and a Stalin. And Mao himself is of a higher intellectual caliber than Stalin. He has learned from the lessons of the past. And all these things begin to have their influence in China. And the Chinese have to work under much greater pressure than even even Stalin. Stalin had a very short time to industrialize Russia. And he utilized the resources of the state to do that in the shortest possible time, regardless of the political and economic consequences. Mao has to do the same. Only thing, I don't think that Mao will commit all the same mistakes as Stalin. And in fact, in China today, the struggle between the sections of the bureaucracy has muted struggles, muted overtones of a struggle not only between sections of the bureaucracy, but of the yearning of the masses towards expressing themselves as against the bureaucracy. So Mao had to use, for the first time in a revolutionary way, within the framework of a bureaucratic setup, he utilized the young people as against the bureaucracy of the Communist Party, the trade union. So, to a certain extent, he opened the doors for a revolutionary action, but once again confined it within the general framework of the bureaucratic setup in China. Mm-hmm. As far as Shambhavadasan's line is concerned, I say the Chinese talk of revolution, and they have revolutionary words. The Indonesian Communist Party, which followed the Chinese Communist Party, was one of the most conservative of Communist parties in Southeast Asia.
In what sense?
In the sense that it supported the Bonapartist Sukarno, and he kept the struggle within the confines of the legality of Sukarno's guided democracy, or whatever you call it. The Communist Party of Indonesia did not really aim at a revolutionary propaganda, did not aim revolutionary propaganda and the revolutionary transformation of the situation in Indonesia. Or here in Indonesia we had some of the worst inflation of Asia. What did the Communist Party do about it? It agitated. But surely the people are going to say, look, Sukarno is the man who is responsible for it. He is really the man who is responsible for the rising cost of living. But the Chinese, the Indonesian Communist Party had no word against it.
Yes, but with reference to conservatism, couldn't that charge be leveled at the LSSP now, in the sense that the SLSP can be called a feudal reactionary party, in the sense that it has some elements?
Yes.
And therefore, can't it be said that the LSSP is following a conservative path in line with them?
No. I would say that the situation is fundamentally different. You see, whereas in Indonesia, there is no real parliamentary democracy, and the situation is unstable as between the classes, and the situation is radically different in that the Communist Party of Indonesia, within a short space of 10 years, had built up a membership of nearly 30 lakhs of people. The situation in Ceylon is quite different to a placid situation. There were no revolutionary undertones here in Ceylon. Here we have a parliamentary democracy which all people are bound, and there's a tradition of parliamentary democracy. Anybody, even in a village, they say, please talk about our question in parliament. That's the first thing they tell you. The papers devote an enormous amount of lineage for parliament, that they say in parliament, and so on. People actively feel that parliament is a viable conception. You see, therefore, the situation, the parallel is not there. Secondly, I say that given the situation we had in Ceylon, naturally, I think that the revolutionary road is the clearest, simplest, and purest road towards socialism.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, we are not the disciplined. It's the masses who must be turned. And for whatever reason, faults of ours, I do not know, or the situation, the LSSP, which is the oldest party in Ceylon, was unable to mobilize the backing of the rural masses, which the SLSP had. Now, given that proposition that the LSSP does not reflect the rural masses, we reflect the urban workers. The SLSP, the rural masses. Surely some sort of alliance is necessary in order to take the people forward in their experience. And when we formed the coalition government, we did not say it was socialist. For us, the coalition government was a tactic. The coalition government was a tactic on the road towards the masses being brought into action. Now, whatever the basis of the coalition government, we said we are forming a coalition government on the basis of a 14-point program, which is general propaganda program. But within it, we had the germs of an attempt to break through the framework of capitalism. Now, for us, a revolution is not something which must be done from above. For us, Trotskyists, revolution is something which must come from below, from the masses. The main idea of revolution is that the masses must be in motion. It is the masses in motion which is much more important than the propaganda of socialism. So we thought, first of all, let us have workers' councils. We break through the framework of capitalism and its administration if we have workers' councils regarding industry. We want to have people's committees in the rural areas. We break through the administrative framework in the rural areas and bring the masses into action, into activity. In government offices, we want to set up committees. Now, these three ideas were put forward with the intention of bringing the masses into activity. Once they come into activity, then, you know, a series of steps will follow after that.
That's very interesting. It raises several questions, though. Now, since you quite openly say it's a tactic, doesn't it automatically mean that the SLFP or sections within the SLFP will be suspicious, that they'll feel that you're climbing up their backs?
Good. That is good. And as far as they are concerned, we told them ourselves, this is a limited program, this is what our program is. But today, of course, this question of the United Front is posed and is in operation in a different way from the normal Trotskyist conception. Normal Trotskyist conception of United Front was a momentary thing, for a momentary purpose. This is much more of in the nature of the famous Stalinist People's Front. But we do not consider the SLFP to be a bourgeois party. It's a petty bourgeois party. And a petty bourgeois party in semi-colonial surroundings is a different proposition. This is the point of departure between the LSSPR and ourselves. The LSSPR say, what is the SLFP? It's a petty bourgeois party. A petty bourgeois party is a bourgeois party. For us, it is not that. For us, the petty bourgeois party in a backward semi-colonial country has all the mixtures and the combinations which are explained very clearly in the theory of the permanent revolution. It has these combinations and mutations which work in different ways. There is in the SLFP a progressive section, a reactionary section. You see, these two factors combine. And for us, the SLFP is not a permanent future. It is bound to split in the future. And with the polarization in the country, the left will come over to us and the right will go over to the UNP. I mean, it's pretty obvious even today that this dichotomy is there inside the SLFP.
One split has already occurred, CPM is in the ground.
Exactly.
But looking at it in another way, in a slightly cynical manner, can't also be argued that both 56 and March and July 1960 showed the left that they couldn't get the rural masses, and that in a sense that they could never hope for a parliamentary majority through elections, at least in the foreseeable future. And therefore, the only alternative was to try and ally with the SLFP and try and hold on to their position by this method. And therefore, again, leading to what is the LSSPR name, that you are in the rear of the movement, not in the van, by aligning with the SLFP.
These are, your arguments of course are mutually contradictory, because one is a right-wing argument in the sense that they say, oh, the LSSP clung on to the coattails of the SLFP. To some extent, of course, it is so. But it is a dual process. The SLFP could not have come to power if we did not also partake in the
No contest.
No contest pact, and more than the no, yes, no contest pact of July 1960. Wherever the forces of the urban population and the rural population come together, then the SLSP can stand. That is, even they have accepted that. And no government in Ceylon can be permanent without the participation of the workers in the administration, in the government. Regarding the LSSPR, it is quite possible that we become the tail instead of the van. But there again, I say that the people must go through the experience. Maybe the LSSP will split. Maybe the LSSP will split. And
LSSP,
yes, might, maybe it will split. We don't know. If it is possible that the party might become the tail instead of the van, in which case a revolutionary section will leave it. On the other hand, if we are carrying out a correct policy, we will become the van. But whatever it is, the masses must go through that experience, I think, of putting the SLSP into power, of the LSSP and the SLSP combining and carrying out certain measures. It is pretty obvious today. As a result of our coalition government, the maturity of the masses is there. The polarization of the masses is there. Today, the
but isn't the polarization to some extent undermine your position? It might strengthen the SLSP and the UNC.
To some extent it might. On the other hand, there's a dialectical process going on all the time. While it strengthens the SLSP, within the SLSP, the left is strong. And today I know, as a matter of fact, that in the SLSP, the left is able to combine with Mrs. Manga to evolve a program which, if carried out, will result in a complete transformation of society in Ceylon. Whether if you carry out the program that you have agreed to or not, I cannot say. That only the masses can guarantee. That as the events unfold, the pressure will be built up. If sufficient pressure is built up, then it can be enforced. But the very fact that they are agreeable to a calm, deep-going program, which should be implemented even within the framework of a parliamentary system of a changed nature within the first 6 months, is a transfer. And the experience of the masters and themselves have taught them that you cannot solve Ceylon problems within the context of capitalism. The UNP has got all the favorable circumstances, which the SLSP will never get, of trying to solve problems within the capitalist system. I asked Mrs. Manal, what is left? There is the right road, and there is the left road. There is no in-between. And before I finish that, as regards the LSSP, today the arc has broken, sections of the younger people have come over to us, a lot of its members have dropped out of activity, and the only thing that keeps it going is the mercantile union and the dynamic personality of Balakampo. As for Balakampo, the supreme egotist is a very capable man, and he has built a strong union on a strategic front. And the LSSP has become the tail of the CNU. And this is more than clearly shown that the general secretaryship of the LSSP has been moved away from Mr. Edmund Samarakodi's hands into Balakampo's hands. I got that.
So there are some more ghost of questions. What would you say to the criticism of the Mao people here, that you, even you and CP for that matter, CP Moscow, are a bourgeois democratic party, and the attempt of this Mao group to pose as true revolutionaries and following the revolutionary line?
You see, we had this type of criticism in the 1928 period also, when Stalin had ultra-left period. Yeah, they went about knotting all sorts of lies. revolutionary phraseology. The question is this: how far has Shambhavadasan an impact on the mass of the people in the city? I say zero. He has some sections of the workers, but they are not the decisive section. And his influence, even in the working class field, has daily declined.
Oh, has it?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt.
Can you give an example?
Look in the rubber and tea trade. At the very beginning, when he split away from the CP, he controlled most of the places, with friends, book bonds and so on. But the Moscow wing has been able to recapture them, sometimes with our support. In the estate areas, he certainly has a following, less than ours.
Among the students too, he has a bit.
Amongst the students, a bit. But now take the strikes that have taken place. I was at Pierre recently. Yeah, the Chinese group was allied with the Moscow group, who had infiltrated the SLSP and had made a chap president. It was really a Stalinist. Now, with the strike motion, the Stalinist SLSP decided not to come out on strike. The Chinese boys crossed over and worked with us. Now, as far as Colombo is concerned, we have a supreme position there. Vidyodo, we have a supreme position. Only at Vidyalankara has a Moscow government. But not Shamanda. You see, the reason is this. In Ceylon, politics is not a simple thing. It's a complex thing. Our society is a complex society. We're still having the mixtures. Still having mixtures from feudalism and so on.
Now what you want is a failure.
Caste is a very strong consideration. Religion, nationality, whether you are a Tamil or a Sinhalese or a Berber, these are also very important considerations. So, from that point of view, Shambhavadasan is very, in a very difficult position. Because it is a matter of the cadre also. You must have a cadre capable of appealing to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
It is not an accident that the leaders of all political parties except Shambhavadasan are going on a Buddhist. It's not an accident. It is part of the framework. It's useless of saying that, well, succumbing to our background and so on. But that is so.
But isn't a caste declining in importance? Now, many people have spotlighted Colvin's difficulties in Adilwasa, but when all is said and done, the important fact is that he got more than half the vote in a predominantly Goi Gamadis.
It's a great victory from that point of view. It's a great victory. And it shows the extent of politicalization in the Kalpana district. And of course, we have built up organizations there also. There were, you know, perhaps even our organizations were infected by the fact that the caste question was raised. But I still say that if all things are taken as equal, the caste may be the result. For instance, it is silly for us, say, to put forward a minority caste man in a majority caste area, or a majority caste man in a minority caste area. Because we are then going against the stream. Whereas if you swim with the current, you can probably get an advantage.
I was interested in your suggestion about workers' councils and people's committees. Under a pressure of modern conditions and in a society where there are rising expectations, as distinct, say, from Tsarist Russia, where they had nothing, are these committees workable, practicable? Will they be efficient enough in the modern context?
Well, you see, in a modern society where a person's satisfaction, the area of satisfaction keeps on becoming larger, maybe modifications of the workers' council system has to be worked out. But it is clear to me that insofar as workers' prices have been operated in the U.S. They have been abused. From the point of view of the index of industrial production, the start year, up to 1962-63, Yugoslavia had one of the highest rates of development in Europe with workers' prices. And nobody claims that they are perfect. There are lots of shortcomings. So we know that workers' councils, even in a society which is in serious transition from agricultural to industrial, and which is becoming a developed society, can work. Workers' councils are workable. Take a country like Finland, which is very backward, politically, economically, and socially. Workers' councils are an answer to our lack of discipline. As a nation, we must recognize that we have no discipline, which is the hallmark of a non-industrialized society. I know that
In the present situation, doesn't Mrs. Bandaranaike hold the key to this transformation which you hope to achieve?
Because I feel that the interest of personality in backward countries is very important. The role of the individual is very important, much more so than even in European countries.
In fact, my interviews are based on that principle.
I feel that. Because, of course, even Mrs. Bandaranaike can be rejected for personality because of the background. And there is a dialectical interconnection between the personality and the historical process. But nevertheless, if this is Bandaranaike, we are not going to get it. I would say the situation would not be so favorable towards our lines of thinking.
Well, anyway,
I think that she, to a certain extent, holds key, just as much as Sukarno held the key in Indonesia. And is he acted in a more decisive way towards socialism? You see, now take Sukarno. He wanted to project himself on the world stage. He wanted to give some charisma to the Indonesian people, the establishment of a greater Indonesia, fight against Malaysia, fight against Dutch Indians. All this had their repercussions. It is true that he stirred up the nationalist feelings and bound the multi-million islands of the Indonesian archipelago together. But what happened as a result? He built up the forces of the army, of the army. So, I mean, it depends on how you work. Personality is a very important thing. I think today, for instance, there is a crisis in the leadership of all the parties in Ceylon. In one way, I can say the NSSP has had a greater number of people suited for leadership than any other party. So the Communist Party is a great dearth of leadership in the day that Vikramasinghe and Peter Kenneman disappeared, there's only one Sarasvati Rama who is to take their place.
What has led him into the people, as far as you know?
Sarasvati Rama. He was formerly in the NSSP. He has a in the law college. He was in the NSSP. Well, you know, there are various things that lead people away. I consider him to be a devout Stalinist, in the sense that to him, I asked him a question about what happened with the Soviet Union and about the massacre of the peasants, Kulak, Stalin. So he said, on the historical scale, what is 3 million? No, that sort of thing for me. So, I think from the point of view of the crisis of the leadership, the SLSP itself, the number of capable people who really understand that is limited.
The plan you suggest for the LSSP policy of awakening the masses would seem to be a long-term plan. And one of the problems
would seem to be that the leadership in the electricity, while you have got young leaders, young men, same side of the top, who have been there since the 30s, and at that age, their tendency would be to look at it in a short-term lens. There is a danger there, isn't it?
Well, I do not think that they themselves look upon it, because some of them, in my own personal knowledge, they feel that the historical process might leave them behind and to occur in the future. So I don't think there is any particular pressure in that way, although there may be some people, there may be, quite possible. But I also feel that today there has come a certain crisis in the leadership in that sense of contradiction between the generation of the generation of the 30s and the new generation. And this contradiction has to be bridged. And I feel that the NSSP is the best party to bridge that contradiction, because it has a wide spectrum in its leadership. People of all ages belong to it. And I feel also that a new element has come on the scene. A vast, educated, unemployed army of middle-class intellectuals. This element is only just coming into the historical scene. Before that, as you know, in the University of Iran, everybody was a cop.
Yeah, why do you say middle-class? Some of them are not even that, but they are intellectuals. By virtue of education.
Middle class in the Marxist sense, I'm thinking, a petty bourgeois, people who come from a peasant background.
Oh, yes, I see. Mm-hmm.
But not a working class background.
Leaving the present aside, I was still interested in the time you came back, in, say, around 52, was it?
52.
You would have had a choice of joining the United Front, Philips and Peters, and...
No, that happened after I came, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And NMs and Colvin's and Leslie's group. Did you have any doubts on
no
that?
No doubts. Not at all, because I thought that the line of the party was the correct line.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, to some extent, from Europe, we thought that the NSSP might go under to the CP because of the impact of the Chinese Revolution, the vast resources available to the Communist Party. We thought that these factors would overwhelm the NSSP. But we have proved to be much more resilient than that.
Mm-hmm. Now, throughout these years, 53, 54, 55, CP was trying to bring all together, you know, the famous United Front.
Yeah.
What prevented that? What led to their failure?
I think the Communist Party was constantly opposed to Trotskyism. After the death of Stalin, of course, the situation started to change, but while Stalin was alive, we were always thought of as the line of your social fascists or agents of Japan, Germany. And therefore the Communist Party was the last agency which could have brought this into being. For instance, when it came to choosing the leader of the opposition in 1952, the Communist Party voted for Banda. And not for. So, you see, we always consider the Communist Party to be our antagonist, not our enemy, but our antagonist within the working class arena. And we were naturally a constant reminder to the Communist Party of its policy of moving away from Marxism.
And wasn't one problem their insistence that you shouldn't criticize the Soviet Union in public?
Yes, of course. At one time, in fact, there was a great danger of unification of the Communist Party and the LSSP. There was a substantial number in our Central Committee, equal number of those people who wanted to have one party in Sinai. they were influenced by the Chinese Revolution and the events in Europe.
Ah, this would be the split in 53, when
right.
William Silva...
Right. Subasinghe.
Who led that?
Right. That was led by William Silva, Subasinghe, and a group of people who later became Stalinists, Reggie Pereira, and a group of people who are now the leading lights of the Communist Party of Sinha. Pandita, K.P. Silva, and Samarvika. They have become the second-rung leadership. And I say even the first-rung leadership, having the closest connections with the apparatus of the Soviet Communist Party.